Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our Sunday morning discourse. Today, the topic is appearances and are things what they really seem to be and how do we know what they are? So we all function as if we completely understand what's really happening. Okay, we look outside, we see a tree, that's a tree. We look inside, we see a chair, that's a chair. We look at the kitchen, I feel hungry. Well, that's hunger, I need food. And yet beneath all of that are a myriad of processes that are taking place. And so far in our discourses, we've discussed that. We've discussed how there's object, there's contact, there's feeling, there's perception, there's mental formation, and how there's a whole process that goes on to orient and place each object, each thought, each feeling in our experience in its respective position. Usually, we've also discussed that usually that position is something that we've been taught or we absorb through our years. The orthodox among us would be people that put it exactly as we were taught by our environment of our parents or our religion or our school or schooling or whatever that was. The more radical and iconoclastic among us would be people that create new structures and put it in new structures so that we have something different. The egotistical among us would orient it in a way that serves only us and nobody else, or at least us first. And the more altruistic of us would put it in a way that serves others equally, if not more than ourselves. So when we look at the environment, to try to understand what's really happening, we have to also understand what we're really seeing. And what is the illusory fact and what is the actual? If we were to go down to the very basic, to the essential structure of what things are made of, the constructs, we understand that we would hit the molecular level, then we would hit the atomic level, then we'd hit the subatomic level. We also know that by science estimation, there is about 10 to the 49th power, that means 10 with 49 zeros after it, more empty space in an atom than there is actual solid matter. If we went into the nucleus of the atom, which has the proton and the neutron, we would then find probably equal amounts of empty space among the subatomic particles, the gluons, the muons, et cetera, et cetera. We don't need to get into detail. But to understand what that might look like is if we think of our solar system and we think of our sun as the nucleus of an atom, and then we think of each planet as an electron going around the atom, and think of the differences of space between the sun and then Mercury, and then Venus, then Earth, then Mars, then Jupiter, then Saturn, then Uranus, then Neptune, and then Pluto, the vast amounts of space. Well, that's actually just a model of also what's happening at the very smallest level. So what's really happening around in our world is just objects in orbit around other objects. And what gives it appearance, whether it's color or its shape or its form or its actual consistency, is how these small bits that are orbiting other bits are connected to each other. And how they connect to each other depends a great degree on the energetic vibration that they share and they participate in. Well, what do I mean by energetic vibration? Because scientifically speaking, that's a very metaphysical concept. But I'm not a scientist, but I think I could presume to say that vibration may be equivalent to the forces of strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, and gravity and electromagnetic force, which is what holds the parts together. So depending on the nature of the forces and how they configure themselves, we get a plant, or we get an animal, a biological entity, or we get a light ray, a photon from the sun, or we get a gas, the smell of natural gas coming out of the earth. And yet all of these things are made of the same basic building blocks. So for example, in our body, if you've been following the news recently, there was an article yesterday about DeepMind, the program that I believe it's Google is working with IBM to create this super artificial intelligence and computer relating to the human body and health. And what they are going to do, because they've just accomplished, is they're going to publish the entire collection and structure of proteins that exist for human beings. And proteins are, we all know protein builds muscle, protein repairs tissue, but proteins are consisting of amino acids. And amino acids are smaller molecules that form and can form on each other and fold in on each other and open up in three-dimensional form. And depending on how they fold and how they construct each other is what kind of protein they create. So now DeepMind has analyzed and come up and categorize and catalog all of the existing amino acids and proteins that form the proteins, and they're going to publish it so people will see this is what we're made of. Based on these amino acids and these foldings, these proteins, this is how the human body works. And yet, when we look at each other, we don't see or small orbiting particles. We see shapes, we see forms, we see thin people, we see fat people, we see tall people, we see short people. That's even before entering into the qualification of we see attractive people and we see unattractive people. Now that's a very important difference between the actual physical structure and the interpretive structure. Does everybody understand what I mean?
Yeah.
The physical structure is the form. But of course, the interpretive structure is whether we like the form or not. That gives rise to another question. Is it possible that our preferences, meaning whether we like the form or not, can change the way we see a physical form? So perhaps if we prefer tall, thin people, then when we see someone who's not tall and thin, we actually don't see them as they actually are. We start to see them as something that we don't prefer. And therefore we see them differently. We so commonly assume that, okay, I see a person, there's their form. And that form I like or I don't like. That's the appearance. But what if it's, I like what I see or I don't like what I see, that then gives us the image of the form. Does everybody follow me? It's a very interesting question. And this comes back to the topic of today's session, appearances. What is it that we're really seeing? Are we seeing something that is, or are we seeing something that is in our head that we want to see? Or are we seeing some fantasy or imagination that's only being generated by what our senses can perceive? So how does this apply to Epictetus and the Enchiridion? Let's move away from what I've been discussing slightly more from a Dharmic point of view, but if we move towards Stoic point of view, defining things that are within our sphere of control and defining things that are outside our sphere of control requires something, or let's call it a prerequisite. And the prerequisite is the ability to define. All agreed? Before we see what's within our control, or before we can know what's within our control or outside our control, we have to know it is what we're seeing. Otherwise, how do we know if this is within our control or not within our control? We have to know what does it mean to be in our control. And the senses we have are the senses that we possess. Now, in the Greeks, they referred to the five senses, but in the Dharma, we have the sixth sense of the mind. So we have to be able to perceive these things and know what we're perceiving in order to be able to categorize them as within our control or outside our control. So how does one know what one is seeing? That's a question. How do you think one knows what one is seeing? Anybody can respond.
Well, I'm afraid that everything we see
I'm trying to find the right word, is confused by our judgment. Our judgment, the way we are, our memories, our feelings, basically. So we only see our world.
We only see, we lost the last part of that. What was that, Johnny?
We only see our world, the world that our mind has been through the years.
Okay. Do you think it would be... go ahead.
No, go ahead. Do you think?
Do you think it would be accurate to say we can only see what our faculties, including our mind and opinions, allow us to see? Or we are able to see?
Yes, definitely.
So, for example, person A does something. Person B looks at what person A has done and says, what a lovely thing that person has done. On the other hand, person C looks at what person A has done and says, what a horrible thing that person has done. So person B and person C are both observing the same action, but come to completely different conclusions. A very good and common manifestation of this is relationships that go wrong. A couple, hetero, gay, LGBTQ, whatever, are in a relationship, or a business relationship for that matter, even. And something occurs. And they both, the two parties, A and B of the relationship, go to speak to person C, who is the mediator. And person A tells a story. And person B tells the story. And the mediator, person C, is saying, wait a second. These are two completely different stories over the same occurrence. So here we have a situation that the same thing occurs, but appears differently to two different people, and probably to everybody else that would look at it slightly differently. So without... excuse me, without a common shared understanding of what things represent that we see, there's an inherent difference in the way we'll be able to perceive. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very much.
So over the last year of our classes, I think it's now been about a year that we've done the discourse, all in all. We've discussed how is it that we can come to see our environment accurately? How can we answer the question, what is really happening here, as accurately as possible and functionally accurate, meaning that the answer is not just an accurate answer, but it functions for us in improving our ability to function in a harmonious and balanced way. And we have come up with several techniques. We've mentioned several techniques, one of which is, of course, sitting and breathing, deep breaths or equal breaths, doing Vipassana. Others is asking the question, what is really happening here? We introduced a new technique from the option method that I mentioned to you several discourses ago of the what, the why, and the what if. What is happening? Why is it happening? What if what I'm observing is not really what's happening? Which opens the door to different modes of perception. And these are tools to be able to see what's actually taking place. So today I'm going to introduce a new concept that I'd like you to consider. And I'm going to give to you an image so that we can see and discuss what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I sent you a PDF up, or I sent a PDF in the group. And the PDF is based on the theory of quantum gravity. Now, I can't go into a long explanation of what quantum gravity is, but there is a great book by a physicist called Carlo Rovelli And Masha, perhaps you could type that in. And it's a book I would highly recommend. It's very readable. He's writing for the layperson. He's not. Pardon?
It's the one on the laws of physics.
The basics, he has several books. Physics. No, this is more on quantum gravity specifically.
All right.
And the reason I highly recommend it, it's very easy to read. It's fascinating, actually. If you look at the image on your screen, the first image, reality exists in fields. And this is something that quantum physics and quantum mechanics, as they've been brought together, has helped us understand. This is related and was first touched upon by Einstein in his theory of quantum physics and how space-time is actually connected and how a planet will bend space-time and affect the gravity around the planet. And therefore, for example, if we're looking at an object through a telescope into space, that's many, 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 many hundreds of, I don't know, billion light years away or a million light years away. If there is a larger object between us, like a star or a galaxy or something, it will have a gravitational field that will bend space-time and affect the light as it reaches us. That's one of the techniques they use to tell time, how far away an object is, by a shift in the spectrum. Well, this is great. We can talk about this in the physics laboratory or the astrophysics laboratory, the astronomical laboratory, and say, oh, yes, this works out in space. But what's really happening all the time is we exist in this field, even on this planet. Now, many metaphysical traditions, and many religions for that matter, have talked about this in many different ways as well over the last 2,000 years, which is one of the most interesting phenomena for me to look at, is how, for example, Taoist theory, some Buddhist theory, and some Hindu theory actually described very accurately what we are now seeing in quantum sciences, like quantum gravity and the quantum gravitational field. But without going into that kind of comparison, let's talk a little bit about the field. So the thinking and the evidence that seems to be displayed now shows us that there is no such thing really as empty space. Everything exists in a quantum field or a gravitational field. And what's happening is that there are packets. A quanta in Latin means a quantity, an amount. A quantum is an amount, like a sum in English. And at first was used to in science to relate to light. So photons, which are the elements of light, exist and move in quantum packets. That's the smallest possible group of photons that move that can be detected. So that's a packet. It now seems and is evidenced by research that space also exists in quantum, or quantum gravitational quanta, that put together go through and match up next to each other and create a field that everything exists in. Pardon my voice today. Excuse me. So what that means is that despite the perception that there's space all around me and then there's me, or there's space all around you and then there's you, there is only one quantum field, gravitational field, of which we are all part of. And the blending of that which we describe as around us and that which we describe as us is actually illusory in the absolute sense, meaning we perceive or appearances, we talk of theme of today's discourse, tend to make us see that we are separate from the space around us and there is space. But in actual reality, there is no difference. There is only one quantum gravitational field of which there are many different kinds of structure, one, a biological structure, which could be us, or two, a gaseous structure, which would be the atmosphere, or what we perceive as empty space. And we know that empty space around us is made up of nitrogen and carbon dioxide, of oxygen and other gases. And that's what we call the atmosphere. We know the atmosphere at sea level, where we are now in Los Angeles, or at mountain level, perhaps where someone is in the Alps or in the Himalayas, is completely different consistency. There's less oxygen at higher levels and more oxygen at lower levels. So even the atmosphere has changed. But in fact, if we look in the absolute sense of what we're consisting of, which means atoms, molecules, atoms, and subatoms, subatomic particles, it's one field. So far, is that clear? Is that confusing?
No, no. Fine.
Quinn? Question, Quinn?
It's just a little bit scientific for me.
Okay, so that's what I want to clarify. So what you're looking at on the screen right now is kind of a rough diagram of a gravitational field that's moving through everything, okay? You see that? Now, I'm going to scroll down to this artistic depiction, and here's an excellent depiction of how we exist in space. So if you could imagine yourself as that person, you exist in space that is three dimensions, and you actually float there. Well, Oren, that's ridiculous. I'm walking on the planet Earth, and I'm not floating anywhere. Well, actually, the planet Earth is floating in space, too. But if we understand that all material substance things have 10 to the 49th power more empty space than actual matter, then we are actually literally all floating in space all the time. Do you follow that? And so the gravitational field, the quantum gravitational field, is not something that disrupts us necessarily, although I guess it could in theory. But it's something which everything exists of. Now, why do I say exist of and not exist in? Because we are not separate from it. We are part of it. It permeates everything, even the objects that are in it. Because we are mostly empty space, so it has to permeate everything in it. Follow? The image, can you follow the concept?
Yes.
So I've often spoken and taught classes and described the difference between what is called qi gong and nei gong in Chinese. Gong, for our purposes, we could say means a kind of work, kind of practice. Qi means energy, and nei means internal. One of the big differences is that qi requires the mind, or the yi, the mind, intention, to make it move. Whereas in the nei gong practice, we actually withdraw the mind so that we blend into the quantum field. Do you understand the difference? We open our perception, we open our understanding of appearances to accept and embrace the fact that we are part of this field that is constantly shifting and moving, even though we seem to be separate of it. And
so
through...
everything will all connected?
Yes. It's all connected. That's exactly correct. And anytime there was something called in, I don't know whether to call it physics or metaphysics, but something called the butterfly effect. Have you heard that term before? Where
Yes.
The butterfly flaps its wings on the other side of the world and it affects something on this side of the world. Well, that is because we're all connected. And in theory, a thought, these thoughts that we're sharing right here, right now, can be instantaneously, and I mean instantaneously, perceived in China by someone who is on this wavelength and sensitive to it. Because we are all connected through this field, and the field moves instantly. There's no delay.
So can I ask a question? Sure. When you talk about Qigong and Neigong, if Neigong is more withdrawing oneself, the mind, and merging with the field and feeling more interconnected with the Qigong, mean that it is less so, it's more disconnecting?
The Qigong asserts the self stronger and creates, it still moves Qi, and you still have the sense of being extremely sensitive to energy, both your energy and somebody else or some other object's energy, but your sense of identity is reinforced. And therefore, you are less integrated into the field. You may be more aware of the field, but you're less integrated into the field. Does that make sense? So for example, a wave comes through the field, and if you're a great master of Qigong, you can perceive the wave. And then you can work with the wave, but you are still perceiving the wave and working with the wave. If you're a great master of Neigong, the wave comes through the field and the wave just moves you naturally. You don't even think about it. It's spontaneous. Now, at this
point, sorry.
Go ahead.
You don't react to it. You just perceive it. You don't react to it. You just perceive it. You don't make it yours.
No, it becomes yours automatically without you having to think about it. So
when it just naturally become part of you, so that's Neigong?
Yes, when person masters Neigong, they are becoming part of their environment as if they're camouflaging, like an octopus suddenly becomes part of its surroundings. Although an octopus is still separate, but it's not exactly camouflage. The actual wave moves through the body. And I'm going to let you experience that before the end of the class today. Interesting.
This makes me think of if a person is not even familiar with practices like Qigong or Neigong, we were starting off the class with the way we perceive things and situations, and that perhaps if we perceive the world around us without too much of us being in the focus of it all, so I guess withdrawing that sense of me more, then it would be a different world. It would relate to each other differently, and perhaps we'd see things as they really are, and would agree more on what we see, what we perceive. I'm just thinking of several events that took place in the last couple of months since we're in LA, and how just interacting more with people, we're being more social, and how it's clear that mostly everybody talks about a situation or relates to a situation through that sense of me, how it affects me, what do I get from it or what I don't get from it, and as opposed to putting oneself to the side somewhere and just letting the situation kind of embrace the situation. Or yeah, sorry, it just came to me this image after what we discussed.
Okay, that's correct. And it's very easy to do that because of the training and habits we have from childhood. And this is particularly one of the main emphasis of Buddha Dharma teaching and practice. It's also a primary emphasis of some Taoist traditions, not all. And it is touched upon in Stoic philosophy, but from a slightly different perspective. the Stoics did not believe that there's no I, where of course the Buddhist philosophy believes there's no I. It's an amalgamation, a construct, and an incorrect construct. And the perception of that construct as an I being separate is the source of suffering or dukkha. The Taoists often perceive that the source of dukkha is the imbalance between yin and yang, while acknowledging that yin and yang is manifesting in the form of a being. And in the Stoic, they don't spend so much time on the matter of God and the ontological origin or nature of things, but rather how to deal with it so you can function from the perspective of oneself in a happier and more content manner, more balanced manner. But in principle, what you have just said is correct, that, or what you've described, when one can be in the field and be of the field without separating the I out, it's an entirely different perception. And this is often something that people describe when they take different kinds of drugs, whether it's LSD or psilocybin from mushrooms or ayahuasca or different shamanic ceremonies. So many people describe, I'm completely one with nature, I melt into the floor. The perception of separation dissolves and suddenly one is completely part of the field, which is what is really there. But because of certain functioning, we see it slightly differently, or what we call relative reality. Now, this is something that's very interesting when we take the perspective, and I think this will perhaps clarify something for you, Johnny, based on your question. We look at the great Zen masters. The great Zen masters spoke of both being and not being at the same time, or neither being nor not being at the same time, or especially when we speak of the emptiness and the school of Nagarjuna and the writings of Nagarjuna of the second century. Because to say I am only the field, or we are just in the field, well, we can't deny the fact that if I drink a lot of tea, I need to go to the toilet after a certain period of time, because the body has to empty the fluid. And yet at the same time, if all I see is the body drinking the tea and going to the toilet, and that's my requirements, then I'm not being perception of the actual feel that's taking place. So between a relative reality of this being and functioning as we are, and the absolute reality of everything of being a part of a quantum gravitational field and functioning, how do we synchronize the two? And that was the great realization of many of the great Zen masters, of just being.